This podcast is primarily recorded on the traditional territories of the Huron-Wendat and Haudenosaunee peoples, in Cataraqui, or Kingston by its colonial name. We center the rightful stewards of this land in order to unsettle our fight for collective liberation. Hello and welcome to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance, a podcast from Eau Prairie, Kingston. I'm one of your hosts, Maha, and today I am so excited to speak with a subgroup of the Abolitionist Dream Mappers, a collective operating through Queens and the wider Cataraqui-Kingston community. Mana, Beverly, and Renee discuss abolition as a relational project and the central role dreaming has in imagining and co-creating futures of collective liberation. And just to keep noting this, we are always looking for queer Muslim guests to feature on the podcast. Check out our very first post on Instagram for more details on how to get involved, or send us a DM on Instagram, or email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com. So hello everybody.
Hello.
Hi.
Before we get started, let's do the introductions. So what are your names, pronouns if you'd like to share, and where are y'all based?
I'll start. So I'm Beverly Osazua. My pronouns are she and her, and I'm currently based in Ottawa, Ontario.
My name is Renee Whitaker. My pronouns are she and her, and I'm currently based in Whitby, Ontario, which is on the outside of Toronto.
And my name is Mona Dahir, and I'm based in Toronto, Ontario, specifically Scarborough. So the east side, if you know, you know.
Awesome. So let's start off with the basics. How do y'all define abolition and why abolition?
So I've been thinking a lot recently, especially with, you know, everything that's been going on. And when I say everything that means going on, I don't mean to like reduce, but it feels a lot, everything sort of feels atmospheric when we're thinking about like global anti-blackness, when we're thinking about settler colonialism, empire, imperialism, and all of its tentacles, basically, is what I'm trying to get at. Which include obviously the carceral geographies as well. I've been really thinking alongside so many of the different Zooms and so many of the different articles and poetry and literature, and also just, you know, moving and working alongside different people, what abolition means. And a lot of what I've sort of been conceptualizing myself, and obviously within a chorus of other folks who've been doing this work for a long time, is that it's a relational project. Like, to me, abolition is thinking about how we are in relation to each other, how we are in relation to the land, how we're in relation to institutions. Like, what is that, like the naming of that? And then also, you know, figuring out how we can work against it, and, you know, recast into new models, like recasting, you know, these relations in different ways. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking, also specifically, I think it was like a teach-in. There was like 30 million Zooms that happened in the past, like, several eight months, with Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who specifically mentioned something that really struck me. And it's something that I've always been thinking about in my project and thinking about relation and theories of relationality, is thinking about the design of relationships and that being a central part of how we're going to think our way out of this and how we can work together to rethink, you know, these designs and in new ways and alternative ways. So that's kind of what I'm thinking abolition is, and a new world. Obviously, then we can build a new alternative ways of being and being in the world together.
And I'm gonna follow you if you don't mind. And I think that was very clear and definitely hit a lot of like what I also believe abolitionists abolition is. Also giving great citations, which is also important. But I think that it is definitely important to think about restructuring, sort of tearing things down to its core and restructuring from the roots rather than building on top of a foundation that has been built upon the colonial, anti-Blackness, anti-Indigeneity, carceral sort of understandings of relationships. Mm-hmm. So that also is a huge component to abolition for me.
Yeah, that's, I love what you guys have said so far. And if I can just add my little one, two, when I think about abolition, I think about the destruction of what is and transformation into something new. And a lot of the time when I talk to people about abolition, their first thought is the abolition of slavery. And when they initially bring that up, it reminds me of the interconnections between the present and the past. Mm-hmm. And under that understanding, you kind of come to abolition with the idea that abolition is really a promise and commitment to freedom, a promise and commitment to liberation, and the continuation of that promise that started hundreds of years ago. And so it's really carrying that legacy, redefining it, and observing how systems that have historically oppressed us are continuing and really reaching into the ground and pulling things up.
I love that.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I love that so much.
That's all super awesome. I love the emphasis on relationality, and like something that someone said in a previous podcast is that we are all we have. And I think that's such a grounding thing to realize, that we really are all we have, and everything that we do is for and with each other, or should be for and with each other. And that this is a legacy that has started years and years ago, and that we are continuing, which I think is super awesome. Mm-hmm. And I'm super interested, as I'm sure the listeners are too, to know more about your work specifically as a collective. So who are the Abolitionist Dream Mappers, and what is your collective up to?
I can start. Well, the Abolition Dream Mappers kind of started out as, well, I was asked by a friend if I wanted to work on a project on abolition. It was a collective project with a few other students at Queen's, as well as a supervisory professor who's organizing this. So I was just kind of stoked to join on and also meet and, you know, reconnect with people that I'd seen. That's how I sort of came in. How I came into the project was through a friend who asked if I wanted to be a part of this sort of collective project about dreaming abolition through arts and sort of alternative ways of thinking about it as a collective collaborative project. So I was super stoked to do that. And my group with Beverly and Renee, we were sort of thinking about storytelling and collaborative modes of storytelling as part of the project of dreaming. Which is a method for thinking about abolition, for practicing abolition, is retelling or producing alternative stories to the singular story that we've been told, which is that, you know, there is this enduring violence that is always inevitable for Black folks, for Indigenous folks, for incarcerated folks, for migrants, for disabled folks, like all of these sort of interconnected relationalities. And that was sort of how I entered into the project. That's sort of my interpretation of the work that we're doing, but I'm sure Renee or Beverly can speak more to the specificities of our project.
Definitely. So like Minna was saying, we were kind of brought together under the supervising of Professor Lisa Gunther. She brought together a bunch of academics, non-academic researchers, and just people who she thought would be really interested in abolitionist dream mapping. And it's the title of it just allows for so much creativity and imagining. And so while our project deals specifically with youths and children, a lot of other projects are looking at various areas. So there's a lot of diversity, but we all come together in the ways that we interpret what it means to be abolitionists and what it means to like dream new futures. Mm-hmm. For our project specifically, we're working in collaboration with Roots and Wings at Queens. In that program, they work with young girls between the ages of, I think, like 9 to 14. And the Roots and Wings project has been going on for a while. And so we came in collaboration, and we've co-hosted two workshops so far. We have our third one coming up at the end of the month. And with each project, we kind of pose different themes, different questions under this series title of Where Life Matters, Life Matters. And we just try to get the girls to begin thinking about abolitionist themes and how it relates to their lives, and pull out these creative juices and turn them into art as it relates to abolition.
Also thinking about the collective group, I think we talked about abolition, and I think that this collective work is also important because it removes the understanding or the assumption that there is a singular solution. And so in thinking about how each section of this group, our working groups, are creating this large picture of possibilities of dreaming about a world of abolition. It is important to think about it as not just a singular sort of engagement with abolition, but it's also like it's a collectivity, and we're all looking at it different aspects and different groups and different avenues, but we're all aiming towards a similar goal. Mm-hmm. And it's also very important to sort of note.
Yeah, also just jumping on there, a huge part of it, like why we chose to do an intergenerational project, meaning, our contributions in relation to the contributions of these wonderful young friends that we have at Roots and Wings, is that we really wanted to take seriously the dreams, hopes, aspirations, sensibilities of fears, concerns about the future, from youth and towards dreaming our collective future, which isn't typically the case. And, if we're thinking about abolition as a relational project, that includes everybody's, aspirations for the futures, and not sort of dictating that for them, but actually centering what they imagine and, wish for and hope for in a world that, they too will be living in, alongside us.
And also the power of the story. Like, I think that I think it's sort of popping up what you're saying, popping off of what you're saying as Lamina, is that like, we young people don't typically have center stage, right? And so to allow the young people to not only have center stage, but to articulate their understanding of what a world would look like without incarcerality in their own words, right? And producing their own theory is something that, we sincerely value. And those conversations between the young and the older creates a space where, both sides are have like equal input. And I think that's also something that we don't typically, something that's not valued as, I don't say it's not as valued, but it's something we don't see as often. And we like to sort of highlight the troops sort of engagement with some really hard hitting theoretical concepts. Mm-hmm. And literally when I tell you sometimes, I'd be like, whoa.
We stay learning.
They're always surprising us.
Yeah, so what were some of the challenges in making abolition something that young girls can understand? How do we begin to break things down to like an age appropriate level?
One of the biggest things was just realizing that abolition, the potential of abolition exists in our everyday lives. And so as we've been talking about relationality, it's coming back to the very basics of human interaction. How do we relate to each other? How do we engage with each other? How do we show each other love and empathy? Mm-hmm. And really solidifying that as like the root. Abolition is about radical love, radical care. And so when we talk about where life matters, we're saying you matter. And so does your friend. So does the man across the street. So does the cashier. So how do we make it so that the society recognizes that all of our lives matter?
Mm-hmm. Love that. That's, just to build off of that, it was an increasingly difficult task in my personal opinion, or like my personal kind of way that I was entering into it. I've worked with children before, but thinking about something as complex as abolition and how to think about, just to touch on what Beverly said, like it already kind of exists, like freedom and liberatory practices are already present, and we just have to sort of reach for them. And in doing that, like in practicing care, as Beverly mentioned, radical love, friendship, solidarity, community, themes like mutual aid and caring for each other, became, you know, vessels for how we're going to talk about the how of abolition within this sort of larger, messy framework of, you know, abolition not as a predestination, but as a process, as an ongoing process, as something that we've been doing and we will continue to do, and, you know, in our everyday lives, not just sort of like this abstract theoretical concept, but actually how do we, yeah, care for each other. And we, some of the themes that we had to come up with, we were using like the metaphor of a tree, as like the metaphor of a tree, in conversation also with Taylor and Yasmin and some of the other wonderful curriculum designers and troop leaders who helped us dream up these curriculums, to teach them, like the idea of a tree being part of the land, being part of something that not only is this like beautiful like living thing, but we need it to survive, and also trees need each other to survive. And also thinking about, yeah, relationships to the land, relationships to a larger community, ecosystems, things like that, and how every sort of moving part is vital to the existence of the entire ecosystem. And that was something that they, I think that they responded well to, because we're using all sorts of nature metaphors and really putting our noggins to work to milk the, you know, picture of the tree for something that could bring forth the idea of practicing abolition.
For me, the challenge was like, really honestly and truly, my biggest challenge was not necessarily the content, but the mode. I am a big nonverbal cue person. So I have a long history of working with people with different needs. And so I'm very like paying attention to nonverbal cues. Like, do you seem uncomfortable? Like, am I picking up vibes? And being in a room, being in my space, which I'm naturally comfortable in, and sitting at a screen, and sometimes, you know, our troops would, or the troops that we work with, would choose not to have their camera on. And so it's really hard to sort of gauge where each person was at. And making sure, like, I think a lot of like program facilitating, and I think this is across the board for all programs, program facilitating is a performance, right? And so the performance piece is also reading your audience. And so it's really hard to read your audience on Zoom. And then also you're zooming people out. So to think like how many times these youth have been engaging with Zoom for the week. I think that's been the biggest challenge, because the theory, they've been providing some hard-hitting theory where I'm like, holy Toledo, like that was dope. And it's also, I think a part of that too is also, you know, encouraging them to continue with that theoretical engagement, And I think that's also something, because I think in general society, children, this whole concept of children should be seen and not heard. You still haven't learned yet. You're still growing. And so to think, to allow these troop members to sort of participate in a way that everything they say is validated and, you know, engaging with it in a way on their level, was actually the most fun.
I can just also hop on to what Renee said, like in thinking about also the limits of Zoom. Was a challenge in thinking about like also the art making practice. Like a huge part of the project is that we are trying to make art with the like our little friends, and how can we do that through you know, the unreliability and instability of like internet connections and Zooms, and making sure people have the materials they need, making sure we had to, there was like actually something that we confronted that actually that blew my mind, because I didn't really think about it because I haven't worked with kids with so long, as we had to troubleshoot on how to copy and paste. And we hadn't really thought about that because we just kind of assumed in our like planning that that was something that maybe that they would have done already. But that kind of confronted us with our own limits, and having to like, you know, think really critically about how we're going to engage these youth in art making practices that, you know, they are comfortable with, that gives them time to work out the kinks of some of the systems we're using, because we're largely digital based and using digital art making platforms, and like trying to troubleshoot in ways that, you know, isn't discouraging for them to like use these things, and also continue on with the program and, you know, do these kind of story building things with us. That was something, yeah, I didn't really think about, but you know.
As Black women based on Turtle Island, what does collective liberation mean to you and for the work that you're doing?
I was thinking about this question earlier today, and while I was thinking about it, I just had this idea of like breathing and the importance of breath and being able to breathe easily or freely. And I don't know how that fits into it, but that was the first like thought that I had. And it was just like, I want to live in a world where we're all able to breathe easily, in every way that that is defined. And so collective liberation for me, really, it is that transformative action of where we're able to just live and be and breathe. Mm-hmm. And so I think this is really important, because it applies not only for where we're at in our lives, but intergenerationally as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to chew on this question, actually, because that's part of the larger scope of everything that, you know, I'm trying to think about, that feels so urgent right now, especially to think about and imagine and practice with, you know, the people in my community, the people I care about and love, people I don't know, and imagining where people aren't able to do that for themselves, like that's part of it as well. But I am always stuck on the process, because I don't know, like I, even to go back to what Beverly mentioned earlier about the fact that practices of liberation already exist, just like joining a chorus of like, you know, wonderful imaginative thinkers and doers and organizers and, you know, creators and poets and, you know, all of the people that I admire and, you know, read and look to when I need to search for something that's not there, you know, in my immediate visions of like a future, is something that I think is a part of the process for me of, you know, returning to things to look for the clues that can lead us to this idea of collective liberation. I also think that's also inherent to like Black expressive cultures. I think it's inherent to like, you know, Black communities in general, like, you know, look, the searching for clues, the practicing, the returning to, the, you know, refashioning openings for ourselves to imagine these collective futures in the face of like this enduring atmospheric violence. And for me, I don't know, like just if I, to put it simply, like what does collective liberation specifically on Turtle Island as a Black woman look like, you know, yeah, would be probably something as simple and as also profound as, yeah, every people being able to breathe, you know, to touch on what Beverly said, easy, you know, Indigenous self-determination and sovereignty, you know, is just people being able to freaking live,
yeah,
do and make and love and care for each other, mm-hmm. In ways that exist outside of these current models that we know now,
mm-hmm.
In radical ways, in capacious ways.
For me, I think that liberation is a combination of the small acts of resistance that persist through, like that are consistent now. And I think of like acts of care, acts of community, and how the communal care, okay, this is really up my research alley, I think. And I think that we do resistance, right? And I think that if we are free to do that and not obscure, but not have to hide and do these things, right? Then that is liberatory, but we still do it, right? So I think that it's reminiscent of what Beverly was saying, like being able to breathe, being able to conduct my acts of care without concern or worry of severe negative consequences. And I think I'm going to give like a really good example. So like a part of what I research is like money sharing practices, right? And I found it really interesting that one of my previous employers, they call it a partner or a lending scheme or a lending practice. And one of my previous employers had that in their policies and procedures, that it's not allowed with any of their employees, right? So when things like that exist, it's like you are trying to make sure that you are constantly pushing down on your employees or constantly pushing down on certain people. So if I'm able to do these things that are helping me to sort of liberate myself, whether it's financially, emotionally, physically, but there are systems in place that keep chronically trying to stop me from doing so, right? A liberatory experience or a liberation for me would be being able to do these things that are innate and natural and comes down from wherever, like wherever I've journeyed from, and being able to freely do so here.
I'm also thinking about the liberation or freedom being that people have what they need and people can get continuous access to the things that they need to live with each other, you know, and in community, and nobody is separated from their community. You know what I'm saying? And there's new models for us to be in communion with each other. So that being, you know, mm-hmm. huge, like no borders, like no carceral institutions, and, you know, no, even like the models of like social life that we are kind of, you know, that kind of infect our interactions with each other, that we're really trying to undo every day, and all of these kind of ideas and ideologies that really stifle us and in being able to you know, organize towards this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if I can add to the breathing metaphor, I think I've thought it through a little more now, because I think especially the wave of heightened protests over the summer, and the death of George Floyd, and I remember seeing everywhere the phrase "I can't breathe," and I have a background in the humanities, so we had to study Abrahamic religions and like in the Bible, God's breathing life and into the earth and all that stuff. And thinking of the power of breath and how it ties into living and being and acting, and in order to even have that breath, the world, the environment has to be, it has to be in a good place. It has to, you have to have clean waterways, you have to have clean air. And so I think the simple thing of seeing breath as collective liberation is so simple but so powerful, because it really is like grounding life in itself.
Mm-hmm. These are all such awesome answers. Thank you all for being so clever and for sharing your time with me. I guess I'll move on to the next question. So thinking about this radical work in relation to queer Muslim resistance, I have an excerpt from the article Muslim Abolitionists on Islam, Carceral Systems, and the Surveillance State by Vanessa Taylor that I'd like to read out. The link will be in the episode description. These words are by Medina, who is based in Toronto. Frankly, abolition is more Muslim than pork being haram. It's a simple belief that humans are created and born free and are given the divine right by Allah to remain free. But freedom is informed by equitable access to life. Imperialism, the surveillance state, police, prisons, detention centers, pretrial detention, for-profit prisons, bail, etc., are all antithesis to freedom. How can we deny freedom to those who are constantly subjugated to state-sanctioned violence and poverty that funnels them into prisons and not call upon our faith? There's a really great quote floating around Instagram a few weeks ago by Chaplain William Sloan Coffin that reads, "To show compassion for an individual without showing concern for the structure of society that make him an object of compassion is to be sentimental rather than loving." I think the essence of this quote speaks to why abolition is so fundamental to all faiths. We pay zakat and donate to homeless shelters. We pray the voices of the marginalized to be heard and for the pain of the world to be alleviated. We look out for our brothers and sisters on the street, so why aren't we talking about the systems that create all the ways our faith is being invoked? So let's talk more about dreaming. To me, dreaming and faith are so interconnected. Why do you center dreaming in your abolition work?
For me, dreaming is integral to abolition, because all of these systems are so embedded within our socialization, within the way that we engage with people, that I feel like to dream is a space where we have no boundaries. It's timeless. It has no restrictions. And so to categorize this engagement as a dream invokes the idea that we're borrowing no ideas, right? Reach for the, you know, shoot for Mars. You know, we talk about shooting for the sky. We're going to shoot for Mars. I feel like Mars is the furthest one. Please don't quote me. I did not do astrology. It could be Venus. Who knows? but shoot for the farthest, like your farthest reach, right? And so like in dreaming, this is why, I mean, I love dream mapping, because it bars sort of all of those ideas of what it means to have restrictions on what you want the world to look like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking in the exact same ballpark. When we think about dreaming and abolition, it's literally like moving into another sphere where there is no limit. The only limit is as far as you can imagine. And so it's pushing you already into this creative, transformative, expansive mindset, and it's only, you take it as far as you want to go. So I think that's the possibilities are endless when you talk about abolition and dreaming. And I remember hearing that in your dreams, any faces that you've seen in your dreams are faces that you've seen before, mm-hmm. right? Whether you remember them or not. And so tying abolition and dreaming, it's still like we're taking those lessons that we've learned along the way, but then reconfiguring them, restructuring them, doing that transformative work. But it still has the things that we care for of the past, the lessons that we've learned.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what both of y'all had said, actually, in terms of thinking about dreaming. For me, dreaming is such an intimate thing, but also pushes, you know, me out, like projects me into different spaces that I didn't know I needed to be in to resolve issues. I'm often a person that dreams about conflict resolution, which is, you know, it haunts me. Like, but I guess it always like reveals lessons to me, as, you know, Beverly mentioned, you know, from the past, in ways that I could, you know, rethink, you know, how to go forward within, like, you know, these common interactions or common, like, disputes or conflicts that I find myself, you know, in or whatever. And for me, it's like the little mundane dreams about those things that often provide me with the largest lessons about how I have, like, how I can conduct myself in the world and how I can align my values with my practice. So I'm living the things that I say that I'm doing. And I often find those lessons in dreams, which is, I think, like a gathering place. Like, I really do believe that it is a constellation for me of the different fragments of not only my life, but of the different histories, you know, that I'm encountering, the different people I'm encountering, you know, the places I'm encountering. It is that sort of place that, you know, and then I have to follow that thread through the dark and be able to make sense of those things. And I think that that's part of that, how the messy how of, you know, abolition. There is no linear way to do this thing, and there is no we don't arrive at freedom. Like, we have to, you know, it's an ongoing process that leads us back there sometimes, that leads us and back there. Wait, we're on a podcast, but, you know, back there, I'm pointing behind me for those who need to know what direction. You know, it is, you know, multi-directional, and that involves, you know, places in, you know, our dreams as well, which is also like, you know, kind of placeless in a way. Mm-hmm. So you know, yeah, it helps me define things. It helps me reveal things. And sometimes we need that revelation, and that's also part of my faith as well, like those revelations. Mm-hmm. And practicing, you know, my own sort of like version of Islam. Mm-hmm. You know, being able to really take those lessons with me, and these revelations, and these sort of intimate ideas of what it means to be in communion with others in this world, by practicing empathy and compassion and stuff like that. And that doesn't mean I'm not a perfect person at all, but, you know, I think that that's what the dreams kind of like are, always giving me a space to work out these issues and reimagine them in new ways that I can take with me into, you know, my life outside of my dream, because I don't really think, you know, like, they're that divorced. But yeah,
I would love to add to that, because I find that I love what you said, that you resolve conflicts in your dreams. And I think that it's, because I used to dream about other people's histories, which is really weird. Like, I would hear stories. My family loves to tell stories. They're some really interesting stories, by the way. But we like to tell stories of, like, their experiences with love and heartache and parties. They used to party a lot. And so it's just very interesting how, like, all these stories, and sometimes they'll creep into my dreams. And so I witness the stories I've been told through the lens of my imagination. And so it does change, like, temporalities. Like, I was non-existent, but I'm here experiencing 1960s and 1940s. And it's really interesting how you can sort of go back and forth in your dreams and sort of understand the world differently based on someone else's experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm also like stuck on the revelation part of dreaming as well. Like I know even with my own familial history, like I feel like in dreaming is so intense, and we like my sister and I often have conversations about the dreams that we have. And I remember like in sixth grade, I used to have reoccurring dreams, like all the same repetition all of the time, where it was the same thing that I couldn't quite make out, the same issue that I couldn't quite place, but I remember feeling it when I'd wake up, like that visceral reaction where like there's some, like this is unsettling me. And you know, I think at the book fair, like I probably stole it, like a dream analysis book, because I was like, I need to understand, like I need to interpret these things because these are so important to me. And like even as like an 11 year old or whatever, or 12 year old, I don't know how old I was back then, but like that connection to this other plane of existence for me was so important. And my sister's too, like not to go too much into it, but she often sees, you know, people who've passed in her dreams, and also has these, I don't call it weird, but you know, these instances where she's able to, I don't want to say predict, but you know, the, you know, there's something in there that then occurs. Mm-hmm. And you know, for me, it always like it kind of like has a chill down my spine. But I also think that this is something that this revelation of like something to come, but also something that's happened before, also unstables the idea of time and like temporality and this linearity that we're like that we're told we're kind of existing in. But I think we're confronting and encountering all of these different things at the same time. So we're always encountering history. We're always repeating. There's always this repetition that we're kind of turning and returning to the same things because we're trying to think about something new. Like we're trying to, you know, experience something different. And I think that that kind of tying it to, you know, my own faith and, you know, tying it to abolition, like, you know, and however we want to rationalize or like think about and imagine our practice, like that is always like something for me that's so huge. Like there's a reason why we're in a different plane and we're thinking about these things and imagining these things, and we've seen it before and we felt it before, or we haven't felt it yet. Like, and you know, that idea of like following the thread through the dark, and you know, and faith in, you know, the things that we know are possible but we don't tangibly, you know, have all of the you know, the different hows, the whys, the wheres, the whatever. So like that is so, I don't know, it's just.
And I think that I love the fact that you mentioned the like, spirituality. And I mean, I completely missed that when talking about dreaming, but like the importance of spirituality and dreaming. Mm-hmm. And like, I think there's one of our members in this collective, he's talking about spirituality and like understanding spirituality through abolition. And thinking about what it means to have that connection through dreams, mm-hmm. right? And so like, how do our ancestors, how do not only our ancestors from wherever we had journeyed from speak to us here, but how do the ancestors from Turtle Island speak to us as well? And how are we sort of dreaming with all of these sort of conversations and connections, and how are we thinking about a future that incorporates all of these dreams? Everybody had a dream for what it looks like for liberation. Mm-hmm. And how do we put them together through understanding these conversations?
And things we don't have the empirical data for. Like dreams are the reveal, like, you know, there's a blueprint for us that we might not have the empirical positivist methods and data like that we've been taught are necessary to provide the maps towards wherever we're trying to like whatever we're trying to discover, which is another kind of colonial myth and story we've been told that, you know, we have to reproduce and like excavate. But I think it provides us pathways in ways we don't like fully understand and fully like, and there's an embodied feeling to that. Mm-hmm. I can go on dreams forever, to be quite honest.
And which dreams do we not talk about? Sorry, I think that's what you're kind of saying too. Like, which dreams do we just dream,
mm-hmm.
right? And hold on and sort of understand that this is a dream that is not to be publicized or not to be, you know, reproduced, but a dream that, like, I feel like sometimes, because even you talked about like things are to come, and I think you talked about your sister having dreams. Like, some dreams are just for meant for you to hold on to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a refusal in that. Like, I don't know if it's, you know, when you conflate culture and religion. I'd be doing it a lot because my sisters are like double my age, so they used to tell me things where I don't know what is a lie and what is the truth. But they told me, like, even Islamically, like, you're not supposed to talk about your bad dreams or, like, you know, terrible things that happen in your dreams. You're not supposed to bring that into the world. And I've always been, like, really superstitious of that too. So, like, yeah, they're just like holding on to these things, and sometimes, like, not, you don't have to share everything, but you know
it's really funny because in like Jamaican culture, like, don't tell nobody your good dreams, make it come true first. so if you tell them a good dream, they're gonna steal it from you, and then you won't have it anymore. So you got to keep your good dreams to yourself. Work in relation.
Before we finish, I did have one question. How do we dream abolition on Turtle Island? But I do feel like y'all have already kind of mentioned that, talking about the messiness of abolition and, like, talking about dreaming itself. But is there anything that you'd like to add to that question?
I'm just thinking about, again, yeah, like, the aligning our values with our actions. And also, I was unrelated, but kind of it'll related, I was reading with a friend and, like, outside of school, and we were having discussions about the text that I've read before, but I felt like I've been reading so much differently. We're talking about the undercommons, but and there was a specific, like, we're specifically talking about this idea, or, like, this liberal kind of politics of, like, debt and indebtedness to each other, but instead, like, kind of rethinking that as, like, I think you might have mentioned this, Maha, like, we owe each other everything, like, we, and that sort of value is something that I kept thinking about, like, the fact that we owe each other in a way that, you know, we can't fully capture in the models that we are, you know, using to understand ourselves and our relations to each other. But yeah, just working and organizing with people, if possible, dreaming, storytelling, you know, thinking with the things that we have at our disposal right now, and the people, you know, being in relation to the people, like, that are doing this work always, in ways that we can. And continuing, yeah, like, mutual aid networks and things like that, and supporting people's movements, like, indigenous movements for, yeah, self-determination, sovereignty, and there's so many things going on right now with, like, the pipeline, Mi'kmaq fishermen, like, there's so many different sites of, you know, self-determination, and, yeah, just supporting them where we can, and supporting each other and making sure we don't kind of get tired while, you know, this laborious process of trying to get free takes a toll.
And also, I think that there is also space for radical care, and so, like, caring for one another, while also caring for oneself. And I think that in that, because it is laborious, it is time consuming, it is emotionally draining,
mm-hmm.
And so taking the time to, like, I think we start every meeting by checking where we are at, like, how our day was, what are we bringing into every meeting, what are we bringing to every space, and how can we as a collective group when we meet sort of share the burden,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, share the burden.
Yeah,
I can't, like, I'm
share
trying
the
to
burden, find, share the load with each
share
other.
Share the load, or, like, really, like, and share care. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so thinking about what it means to be a good supporter of each other, and not just like in that moment, but continually, mm-hmm. right? As we continue to push through and seek for liberation, mm-hmm. because we will get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What can I say? You guys have been so eloquent. It really is that collective support and lifting each other up across Turtle Island, recognizing that our struggles and our freedom are constantly tied, they're interconnected. And so we can't all be free until all of us are free.
Is there anything else that you'd like to plug for the listeners or share where people can find you if you'd be down for that? Or
no, is there a place where you can find our collective group? We will have a website. We'll have a website, the Abolition Dream Mappers website.
Eventually.
Yes, hosted via Modern Fuel Artists Run Center in Kingston. So look out for that. It will manifest
in April.
Yes, in April or something like that, 2021.
Okay, awesome. Well, thank you all for being here today. I really appreciate all your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Queer Muslim Resistance. As always, you can find relevant links in the episode description. Make sure to check us out on Instagram for links to our Queer Muslim resource guide, to Tarif, a Queer Muslim reading group, and for awesome Queer Muslim content in general. You can email us at queermuslimresistance@gmail.com for any inquiries, additional resources you'd like to see added to the resource guide, or just say hi.